Hi, I'm Chuck Mingo, the founder of Undivided, a movement for racial solidarity and racial justice. And this show is called Living Undivided, where every week I bring you someone who is doing that, getting close to the problems that we have in our country and trying to help bridge the divide. I'm here with my friend, Dr. Hari Han. She is a political science professor. She's also the director of the SNF Agora Institute out of Johns Hopkins. So Hari, thanks for being with me in DC.
Thank you for having me. It's great to see you.
Absolutely. So obviously you're based in Baltimore.
Right.
And do work really around our democracy and mm-hmm. how, or maybe how, people aren't coming together. And so we're going to get into that. But your story is so compelling to me. So I want you to just start from, you know, where you're from and what was your upbringing like?
Sure. So I grew up in Houston, Texas. I didn't start out in Baltimore. I grew up as a daughter of Korean immigrants. I was born in the United States, but my parents had immigrated to the United States in the early 1970s. And they came from a really well-established family in Korea, but when they came to the United States, because Korea was still a developing economy, their money didn't really go very far. And so a lot of what I saw growing up was the experience of my parents trying to figure out what it meant to raise a family in the United States and how they can climb that social economic ladder in the U.S. And so, you know, I think when we were kids, I remember my parents used to tell us a story about when they were first in the United States and, you know, they had been working. My dad was taking classes in graduate school. My mom would do various odd jobs. My dad would mow people's lawns or deliver Chinese food and things like that. And one day they got up and they went outside to go to work. And they were driving down the street and it was like the streets were empty. And they stopped at the store and like the store wasn't open. And they couldn't figure out what was going on. They was like, why is everything so closed down? And it turned out that it was Thanksgiving. But no one had told them that it was Thanksgiving. And of course, Thanksgiving is a uniquely American holiday, so they didn't even know to expect it. And they tell that story, they told that story to us because they always said that they had never felt so lonely as in that moment when they felt that everyone else was with family, was with loved ones, and that they were by themselves, and they didn't even know that they were going to have this holiday.
That was like a moment they realized they were in a very different place, a very different country.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And just sort of realizing how hard it is, and all this intangible knowledge that comes with growing up in a certain place that you don't learn, and people don't think to tell you those things.
So did you feel a pressure being the first generation American to kind of bridge that gap, not just for yourself, you're learning it, your parents can't teach it to you, but also for your parents in some way?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think, you know, the decision that they made when they had those kinds of experiences was that they never wanted their children, if we were to grow up in the United States, to have the same experience that they did. And so what that meant was that they chose to, I kind of jokingly say that there is this aggressive program of assimilation where, you know, my mom like went out and she learned how to make hamburgers and spaghetti, but not very well. So I grew up thinking that like Americans eat these like horrible overcooked patties and these like watery spaghetti, you know, because she thought that's what we would do. And they started speaking English at home instead of speaking Korean because they wanted us to feel really comfortable in American culture. And so I think that we did feel a sense of that. My brother and I did feel a sense of that pressure, but it was more this kind of, we were always betwixt and between. You know, there were ways in which our family was still very Korean, but there are ways in which they were trying to help us assimilate into the United States. And I think it took me a really long time to figure out who I wanted to be and what that meant for me.
Yeah. And we talked before that in some ways that experience connected to your work.
Yeah.
So talk about that. What was it that got you curious about this whole idea of how people assimilate, how people connect?
Yeah. Well, so my family was very apolitical growing up. Like, we didn't talk about politics at the dinner table. It wasn't something that I ever thought that I would be interested in. And I went to college and I got involved with a community service organization. And that organization ended up getting in a fight with the university where I was in college. And so that's how, and so then, you know, because of that, we decided we wanted to organize this big rally to protest, you know, this kind of little issue within our university on our college campus. So we thought we're going to have a big rally. And someone was like, well, maybe you should take a class on community organizing. And I never heard of organizing. I didn't even know that there's a discipline or a way of thought around it. So I signed up for this class and I ended up taking a class with someone named Marshall Gans, who is a longtime organizer, and had the privilege of being in a small seminar with him where he taught us the discipline of organizing because he had learned how to organize with SNCC and then with the migrant farm workers and Cesar Chavez. And it was like all of a sudden my mind just opened up in a new way because what I realized was that all the experiences that I had had growing up, it wasn't just an experience that I had had as an individual. They were embedded in a whole set of structures and systems that no one had ever made clear to me. And I thought, you know, when you're a kid and, you know, you have these experiences of people treating you differently because you look different or things like that, you just sort of think, well, that's life, right? Like, you don't really think that there's a whole history or a system that underlies it. But I think organizing felt really resonant because it helped me realize that there was something bigger that we could, and people had an analysis around it. And so it really felt like it spoke to me in a different way.
So you mentioned SNCC and the farm workers movement. Just say a bit more about what those are for people who may not be familiar.
Sure. SNCC stands for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and it was the part of the civil rights movement in the 1960s that really coordinated all the student action that was going on. So the sit-ins at the lunch counters, a lot of the protests and other activity. And Marshall Ganz was a leader in SNCC. He'd actually dropped out of college in order to go down and join SNCC as a college student.
A Jewish man.
Son of a rabbi.
Son exactly. of a rabbi.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the farm workers, what I meant there is I was referring to the movement that Cesar Chavez led to try to organize migrant farm workers. It was originally started in California, but really grew across the United States and into Canada and other parts of the world, where they were trying to really organize the migrant farm workers to fight for better working conditions, better wages, all those kinds of things. And so but for people who grew up in the 1970s, some people might remember grape strikes where you know, people tried not to eat grapes for a long time. That was organized by the migrant farm workers movement.
Yeah. Wow. So talk about the work you're doing today mm-hmm. in the space of those systems and structures.
Sure. So so after college, that's how I got interested in politics. And then I went on and eventually I had worked in politics for a few years. And I felt like when I was on the front lines, I was never able to step back and really kind of make sense of and understand what was going on. So eventually I went to grad school and am now a professor. And a lot of what I do is study and try to understand how is it that we can pull people off the sidelines into public life, and then how do we make their voices matter? And so, you know, it's not just that we want people to be able to get involved, but we want them to want to get involved, and we want them to commit to each other in doing so, and then we want that to actually make a difference in the world out there. So that's a lot of the work that my students and I work on.
Yeah, and I mean, we'll talk about how that work led to us yeah. getting to know each other, but that's one of the things that you've helped me to see is just how much this American project really does belong to the people. Right. And it belongs to us recognizing and taking an active role right. in our democracy. You know, right. you've helped me to see that. And I think one of the reasons that we connected was because our church, Crossroads, and particularly as we were doing Undivided, you said that was a very unique thing. You weren't seeing many places in the country where churches, particularly churches in the Midwest, churches that are predominantly white, like Crossroads,
right.
were getting involved in politics in the way that we have. And so we met around the Preschool Promise Initiative
right.
that was happening in Cincinnati. How did you hear about that, and what made you interested in wanting to learn more?
Yeah, so one of the things that my colleagues and I were working on was this idea that if we look at American politics nowadays, one of the trends that we see, and this is established not just by our research, but by a lot of other people's research, is that just because people take action, it doesn't mean government's going to care. And so we developed this research project. We're trying to understand, okay, we know that that's true in general. People can pour into the streets and nothing happens, and it's really frustrating for a lot of people. But what if we looked at the outliers? What if we looked at the places where a community of people was able to come together and then actually make a difference? Can we learn anything from them? So we spend a lot of time talking to all sorts of experts trying to figure out where are these outliers? Like, where are the pockets where people are able to break through? And one of the places was the Cincinnati Preschool Promise Campaign. It kept coming up in a lot of the conversations we were having, where people were saying, there's this thing happening in Cincinnati where there's a group of people that are coming together, they're advocating for real policy change on behalf of low-income Black children in the city and trying to really combat this question of intergenerational racialized poverty. And so that's how we came to learn about Cincinnati Preschool Promise. And then when we started digging into that campaign, one of the things that we found is that people kept saying there's this church that's sending all these volunteers to the campaign. And I remember talking to the campaign manager, and he said, you know, we have a level of commitment and volunteerism that is unlike anything that you see for a municipal ballot initiative. Like, you just don't see this level of commitment. So we were like, what is going on? And that's how we came to find Crossroads and then Undivided.
Yeah. And so obviously we were so honored that you were interested and wrote an article about the work that we're doing. And since, you've really helped us to dig even deeper and understand what is it about Undivided that is actually moving the needle on that. And so just share a bit about what you're learning, about even the questions we're still asking about Undivided, which is, I think, exciting in terms of our partnership for the future.
Yeah. So let me just sort of step back and say, one of the things that I think is really exciting about Undivided is that, what first drew me to Undivided is this idea that people were not only partaking in that 6-week program, but it was galvanizing them into action afterwards, right? That's how we discovered you, is that there were all these volunteers that were coming out through the justice team to the Cincinnati Preschool Promise campaign. And so we were trying to understand what was that spark, right, that catalyzed people into an ongoing commitment to work on racial solidarity. And so that's when we started to kind of digging into Undivided. And so what we've done thus far is, you know, first we wanted to start by understanding, okay, like, what is the experience like for the people who go through this 6-week program? And to be honest, I think it feels like we're still on a journey, right, of learning
and trying to
understand. But it's been really helpful for me to think about where we've come so far, right? So at first, when we first started studying Undivided, we were looking at people's views on questions about racial solidarity and racial justice and trying to see how those views shifted. And we saw a little movement, but it didn't feel like it was movement that was big enough to galvanize the kind of action that we were seeing. And so it felt like we weren't even asking the right questions. And I think it took us a while to figure out what the right questions were to ask. And then over time, what we're beginning to see is that when we look at the difference between people's experiences when they first enter into the Undivided program and then where they are 6 weeks or a few weeks after they enter into it, what they're feeling is people are moving from a sense of isolation to a sense of community, right? Feeling like they're alone and feeling despairing about where we are on questions of racial justice to feeling like they have a group of people with whom they can take actions. So that's sort of one thing. And then second, that people are better able to understand the perspective of others, whether it's people of color thinking about the experience of being white or white people thinking about the experience of people of color, that even if they don't have obviously a full understanding of what it's like to walk in someone else's shoes,
right,
that people are more willing to try to do that.
Step
and that it's that motivation to continually question and learn, I think, that then moves people into a greater sense of action. And so I think one of the questions that we're trying to understand still have to do with, well, how do those effects play out over time?
Right.
You know, thus far, a lot of the stuff that we've looked at has been in the kind of immediate aftermath of the program. And I'd love to understand how that plays out over time, how you support people in continuing to live that in their own worlds and so on.
For sure. Which is one of the reasons why even the show is something that we want to do, is to continue to give people stimuli to think about, both people who've done Undivided, people who are interested in doing Undivided.
Right.
I want to go back to one thing you said, though, because it's something that really did birth out of the DNA of Crossroads. We talked about this idea of you can belong before you believe.
Right.
And you really think that's a powerful thing, that you don't have to come in agreeing on a whole bunch of things about race or about racial justice, but there's a space for you to journey together. You think that's a powerful part of the deal.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So one of the other things I think that is really unique about Undivided that really drew me to want to understand it is that there are lots of racial reconciliation programs of various kinds all over the world.
Doing great work, right.
Doing really great and important work.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that we've seen, or at least the data that I've seen of the ones that are most effective, they're often operating in relatively small contexts. You know, so if you put me or anyone into a room with a group of 5 people and give us a year to really wrestle with each other, most people tend to be able to come out of that, you know, more united than they were before, right?
Right.
But the challenge that we face as a society is how do we do that at scale? And I think part of what's so interesting about Undivided is that it's nested within this megachurch, right, and is able to think about questions of scale that are in a different way. And so one of the things that I'm really interested in continuing to learn is how does the context within which this work is happening shape people's experience of it? And so to get back to your question about belonging, so in the world that I come from, right, in political science, you know, if you were to take political science 101, the typical idea I think that's out there of voters, of activists, of people in general is that people believe before they belong, right? And we don't use that language necessarily in political science, but it's the idea that if I'm an environmental organization and I want to look for people to support me, who do I look for? I look for environmentalists,
right?
If I am a gun control organization, who do I look for? I look for people who want to support gun control, right? And so the idea is that there are people out there that for whatever reasons have a set of beliefs And then we as an organization try to draw them
in. Put up a bat signal and say, hey, we're your people.
Come to me.
Come to me.
Exactly, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Crossroads, I feel like, is doing something totally different, right? Where it's saying, first, we're going to draw you into community, yeah, right? And you have to be prepared to be offended. You have to be prepared to be challenged.
Yep.
You have to be prepared for all these other things, but we're going to welcome you no matter who you are or what you come with. And that's a really powerful thing, I think, these days. And then I think part of what we're seeing in Undivided is that, you know, people could come to Undivided with that sense of belonging, and then their sense of their beliefs begin to evolve and change as a result of that. And I think that's a really unusual thing in our society right now.
So in your story, and even in mine, there is this journey of assimilation, you know, certainly from first generation Korean, very different than my family who had been in America for longer.
Right.
But still there's an element of assimilation. So would you say, is it true that sometimes assimilation is the enemy of belonging? How does that play out?
Yeah, so maybe I can answer that question in two ways. First, just from my own experience, and then thinking about it a little bit more broadly. So I totally understand why my parents wanted us to assimilate, right? Because they didn't want us to feel that loneliness that they had experienced. They didn't want us to face the social barriers that they felt like they faced because they hadn't grown up in the United States. But on the other hand, I think what that meant was that I always felt like I had to conform to someone else's standards, right? And the standards were set by the middle-class white community that dominated the school that I went to. And that wasn't me, right? It wasn't, I remember distinctly one time, like right at the beginning of high school, it was like the third day of high school, I remember. And, I remember waking up in the middle of the night and I was crying and crying and crying. And my mom comes into the night and she's like, why are you awake, first of all? And why are you crying? Mm-hmm. And the only thing that I could choke out in that moment was like, I just feel like my legs are so short and everyone around me is so blonde, you know? And it was like, I was 13 or 14, I can't remember, but it was just a sense that like, I am not like everyone else and what everyone else is holding up as a standard of what is correct or right.
Yeah.
And so I think that assimilation really raises this question of who gets to set the standard for what it is that we want to be or what is correct.
What's American?
Right. What is American?
What's American?
Exactly.
That's really a question.
And belonging to me is very different, right? Belonging is this notion that no matter who you are or what you come with, we welcome you into our community, and our community is strengthened by everyone's difference, right? And so that all of us are asked to bring our full selves into the community as opposed to just a portion of ourselves that conforms to a certain standard.
Wow.
And that's a really hard kind of community to construct, where I can fully accept you in all of, you know, everything that your whole history and everything that you bring and all the ways in which we're different, and that you can return that to me. It's a much harder kind of community to construct, but I think one that builds a lot more commitment over the long term.
Yeah. It's a more resilient community.
It's a much more resilient community over the long term, right?
You know, we're talking micro. Let's get macro again.
Mm-hmm.
You study this, and as you think about where we are as a country in this moment, I mean, we're in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
doing this because yesterday this place was filled with people.
Right.
And I was here and you were here, and it was about the march on Washington, this commitment march. Just from a political scientist perspective, what are you seeing right now? What are you noticing?
That's a big question.
It is a big
There's
question.
So many
I'm
ways
trying to keep
answer
it broad because I want you to think. I'm like, wherever you want to go with that, I don't know.
So I think we are in a moment of tremendous uncertainty right now in our society. And that's at so many levels, right? That the structure of our economy is changing. America's place in the world is changing. The global economy is changing. And I think that we're at a moment where our country is being asked to reckon with this question of who do we want to be? And race is an inevitable part of that, right? Because so many of the structures that we have in our society and in our democracy are structured on race, right? From the very founding of our country. And I think that a lot of the commitment march that, you know, that we had saw yesterday, but then also all the protests that we're seeing around the country are part of groups of people challenging us to pull off the veil and reckon with that question.
Wow. How interesting. Pull off the veil.
Right. Literally, right?
Right.
Pull off the mask that we have. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And reckon with who we want to be. And one of the challenges that I see is that sometimes it's easy to look at that reckoning and to feel only despair, which I definitely do on days. And, you know, part of what I think is exciting about programs like Undivided, or the part of what we're trying to do at the work that at Johns Hopkins, is to try to think about where are the pockets of resilience and how do we strengthen, you know, those pockets where they exist.
Yeah. I love hearing that. And so for you personally, like you said, it's easy to despair. What's given you hope these days, even in the last few days? What's giving you personally hope?
I think there's a couple ways to answer that. So first, the young people give me hope. You know, one of the things I love about being a college professor is that it's like you're having this constant dialogue with the future, right? And so every year there's a new group of students that are coming in, and young people are coming up there. It's a more tolerant, it's a more diverse generation than any generation that we've seen before. And, you know, my mentor, Marshall Ganz, always says that it's no accident that young people have been at the forefront of social change movements around the world, because they come to the world with a critical eye and a hopeful heart. Right?
I love that.
I mean, anyone who has children know that children are not shy about critiquing you.
And they don't miss a thing,
they
right?
They do not miss a thing, right? But they also have the hope to want to push us to all be better. And I see that in my students every year.
Yeah.
And I think that gives me a lot of hope. But then second is that, is like the work that you all are doing at Undivided. And I think in communities like Crossroads that are growing so fast, which when I see a community like Crossroads that is saying, look, we're going to welcome you into belonging no matter what, and we're going to challenge what you believe even as we welcome you into this community. And the fact that it's growing so much means that it's speaking to a hunger that's out there. And so I think the challenge is not so much with the people, but it's more, can we change our structures and our institutions and society to meet the hunger that people have?
That's so good. So if people want to know more about the work that you're doing and kind of follow and understand more, where would you point them?
Yeah, well, you could always come to our website. It's snfagora.jhu.edu, and sign up for our mailing list, and you can hear about our events and the different work that we're doing. And you can also follow us on social media, where we always post stories and interesting things that we're seeing and thinking about in addition to the events that we have coming up.
Yeah, I follow you on social, and you always do. You have such insightful things. I learn a lot from that. You really do. So Hari, I want to thank you for being on Living Undivided. And I want to tell you that your students are rubbing off on you. Or maybe you're rubbing off on your students, because I would say, when I think about you, you definitely have a critical eye. You ask great questions. You're helping me and our team to grow in ways that we wouldn't if it wasn't for a partnership with you. But you absolutely have a hopeful heart. You do. You're an optimist. Even with all the data that you have, I'm sure, to the negative,
right,
you are such an optimistic person. And I'm always thankful to get to spend time with you and to work with you. So thanks for being a Living Undivided.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It was really fun.